This is a Data Science Channel program from the Holly Giolu Data Science Institute. Visit us at ucsd.tv/data-science to learn more about how data is shaping our future.
Welcome to another episode of Science Like Me Plus. I am Misha Belkin. I am a data science professor at UC San Diego. Joining me today is Yaron Singer. Yaron is a vice president of AI and security at Cisco. He co-founded and was the CEO of Robust Intelligence, which has recently been acquired by Cisco. Before that, he was a professor of computer science at Harvard University and has worked extensively on theoretical aspects of computer science, in particular on optimization. After completing his PhD at UC Berkeley, Yaron joined Google as a research scientist before joining Harvard as faculty. Yaron has been an academic and industry researcher, a co-founder of an AI startup, and now a senior manager at a major tech company. I am excited to have a chance to discuss with him the current state of affairs in industry and academia and learn from his insights and perspective. Welcome, Yaron.
Thanks, Misha.
So let's start with your background. You are an Israel-born computer scientist and academic who has also ventured into entrepreneurship. Can you tell us about your intellectual influences? What made you interested in science and in computer science in particular?
That's a good question. So maybe I should start by admitting that, like, you know, my intellectual influences probably go back to my parents. So my dad is a double E professor at Tel Aviv University. My mom was a physicist. And she got her PhD, and then kind of like worked in, as a researcher, and then later on as a kind of like as an executive, like as a research executive. So, I think I kind of they probably had a big part of like influencing the trajectory, I think. So I think that probably played a part, you know, in kind of my inclinations. So somehow that was always kind of like in the background in the house, whether you liked it or not. So I grew up like, you know, I grew up like kind of not really thinking that I'll, you know, become a scientist. I thought I'll probably do something else. Maybe it's like, you know, you see your parents, you kind of think, okay, I'm gonna do the whatever not of what they do. But yeah, I think kind of like over time, I did find myself, with that kind of like inclination. So I'd say probably my parents have been, you know, the biggest influence on me. So.
And why specifically in computer science did something sort of nudged you in that direction?
So maybe there are some degrees of freedom, you know, like between double E or physics, or I think it was it's interesting, like I think when I go back to thinking about computer science, I remember like thinking that one thing that I'm realizing is that I actually had a pretty like good understanding of what, you know, computer science or theoretical computer science is, I think, even before studying it. And I to be honest, I don't know how exactly, but I sort of realized that it was that it had to do with algorithms and kind of, and at the same time it kind of like it had something where you would it had a sense of like it did have a sense of like an engineering component to it. There's sort of like kind of this intellectual curiosity aspect of it, and I somehow like understood like kind of the discrete like kind of nature of the mathematics behind it, and to me that was appealing. So like kind of somehow like being able to, you know, think of systems and design algorithms for these systems that, you know, and then kind of that have like mathematical depth to them. And at the same time, you can somehow like influence like how these systems are being, you know, like created or engineered, which is, you know, is a little bit more kind of like engineering leaning than, you know, standard mathematics, I think. Then all those somehow like very much appeal to me. So that kind of made me know that I want to study computer science, in undergrad.
So it's some sort of combination of mathematical depth and being able to do something which has some sort of, like, that you can somehow feel or see.
Yeah, I think so. And like, I don't know how exactly I understood that. Because a lot of times you talk to, you know, when you talk to people about computer science, people have a different perspective about what computer science is. I mean, a lot of people naturally think of computer science as being about programming, which, you know, some of it is, but that's definitely not all of it, especially not kind of when you think more about the foundations, whether machine learning, theoretical computer science. And I don't know kind of like how I had that intuition. You know, probably growing up in Israel had to do something with it. It's probably in the air, in the water, or what have you. I think kind of like, you know, I did some, you know, very, you know, programming, like kind of, you know, and I don't remember, kind of like in school, or, you know, so, and somehow like that, I don't know, somehow like I feel like that was kind of like understood to me that there's like an entire science and kind of like a, you know, and mathematical depth behind all this, so, yeah.
And sort of to follow up on this, you worked a lot on optimization, and which is, you know, how do you maximize or minimize certain quantities that we care about. What particularly made it interesting for you? What attracted you to that?
I feel like, I feel like this is something that probably every optimization person says. Everything is optimization. Right, and everything is like life is optimization, or all you do is you try to maximize things or minimize things, So honestly, maybe I'm like one of, you know, maybe I'm a little bit like these, like kind of these optimization people, where, you know, to me, I feel like it kind of struck the, you know, to me it just kind of like struck the fundamental questions that I was interested in, like, you know. I was interested in kind of like understanding what can or cannot be done with, you know, in many cases, the questions were about limited information, like, you know, both in grad school and then later on kind of like, you know, during my time at Harvard. Applied math or theoretical computer science perspective, these questions of like what can or cannot be done, what do we can or cannot do, they always boil down to optimization. And then you use these sort of models to kind of, to ask these questions, like what are the limits of computation? What are the limits of, you know, the things that we could do? And optimization gives you a very good framework to kind of ask these questions.
In sort of in a related question, how do you think, so we have this very nice theoretical question, in particular the frameworks for optimization, how do you sort of use this trade-off between, you have this very rigorous proofs and clean modeling assumptions, and then we have this, you know, very messy, like, real-world data, and you know, who knows what happens, especially now with this like super complex system. How do you view this trade-off?
Yeah.
Or is it a trade-off maybe?
No, I mean, there is, yeah, I think that there's always like, that's a great question. There is always that trade-off I think it kind of goes back to kind of like the art of modeling, right? And we can look kind of at our distant cousins in physics, right? In physics, everything is a ball, everything is a sphere, right? Everything is and obviously the world is not the world is not always in the shape of a ball or a sphere or what have you. But somehow I think the good ones and the great ones, they managed to kind of create a model that basically distills a lot of the, I think, you know, kind of like the essence of what it is that you're trying to capture. So I think there's always complexity, and I think kind of the world that we're dealing with, like, you know, data, I think it's to me, it's very similar to physics. I feel like it's like kind of we're dealing a little bit with kind of like the, you know, the physics or the mathematics of information, and I feel like it does kind of like follow these, you know, the same laws, you know, as the kind of like the physical world or the physical universe. And it does have the complexity, and but you know, like you can never model, you know, if you're kind of like you can never capture the kind of the model in its full complexity. So I think it's like the, you know, the idea is that if you're able to kind of create like a model that is, you know, ideally elegant, and is, you know, you know, simple enough so that you can work with and do something that is meaningful, and then have your kind of like the, you know, the have that model, you know, if you've done a good job if you're somehow like, if you manage to, you know, the results that you show in that model somehow translate into the results of the real world. You've either you've taken this model and you've designed an algorithm, and that algorithm that works on this model later on has, you know, works or has promise in the real world, or vice versa, you basically kind of created a model and showed maybe like an impossibility result, or showed some sort of hardness where that hardness is like is somehow also reflected in, you know, in the real world, and you're somehow able to point to the, you know, maybe some of the reason for why that hardness exists. So that's how I think about this aspect of modeling.
Yeah, that's actually one thing which always amazed me about physics, right? Like you think about the planet as being a point, right? The planet, it's not a point. It's very far from a point, but this is somehow extremely useful, right? It's kind of the power of that is just amazing. It's, I sort of, maybe for, you know, particularly for students, you know, both undergraduate and graduate who may be watching, us, what do you think about the publication models that we have now? It's slight change of subject. Like, it seems that on one side, you know, like we have this conference system which is almost kind of out of balance, right? We have like tens of thousands of submissions. It's a crazy pace. On the other hand, well, it seems that the pace of development of this technology is kind of maybe necessitate that. I don't know. Like, how do you think about it, both from your point of view as an academic and kind of an industry person?
I mean, I'm smiling because I, you know, those are exactly the kind of, you know, questions or dilemmas, or, you know, I definitely was struggling with that as an academic, and, you know, now I'm publishing less, and, you know, so I'm kind of, you know, you know, it's something that I stress about less or think about less, but it's definitely still top of mind for me. You know, I think that, honestly, I think that the peer review publication system that we have just doesn't scale, you know, and I think that it was just not designed for the way that, you know, that we're using it right now. You know, I think that it my guess is that, you know, and I didn't live in those times, but I'm assuming that back in the maybe in the 1920s, 1930s, you know, when you had, you know, 10 people in your community, and you who kind of who worked in like kind of different institutions, like, you know, in the world, and this is kind of like the, you know, and then this is like, you know, obviously before the days of internet and what have you, this is like a good way to communicate, and also kind of like a scalable way to kind of validate results and what have you. And now I think that the world, you know, changed dramatically, you know, and kind of in all these different ways. You know, one of them is the fact that the community, like the academic community that is interested in publishing is very large, you know, but also the means for communication and kind of the rate of change and progress, again, like kind of changed dramatically. So I don't know that system, the peer review publication system that we have is you know, kind of like scales, you know, to kind of, like, or it was the right one for kind of like what we're doing, to be honest. So, so that's my opinion.
Any thoughts on how it should, what it should be like?
Maybe that's a topic for a longer conversation. I think that, like, I think that ultimately it's about what it is that that we're seeking to, I think it, well, like as a person of optimization, like what is it that we're trying to optimize? You know, are we trying to optimize progress? Are we trying to optimize like kind of development? Are we trying to kind of like have a kind of a concentrated talent of experts sitting in an ivory tower? I think kind of like depending on what it is that we're trying to like optimize or preserve, then I think that there are like kind of different methods that are the right ones to apply. So for example, like, do I think that the number of publications or citations that someone has, does that mean that they're like, does that, is that a, necessarily a great measure for like, how good they'll be as a faculty member? I personally don't, right? And at the same time, like, and maybe it's also like kind of not a great measure of like, how great of an AI developer they are, right? Depending on what it is that we're trying to do, I think that like there, we should kind of like consider different approaches.
Yeah, I've been kind of going back and forth myself on this. On one hand, it seems like you say, it seems that the system is kind of fundamentally broken. On the other hand, well, the progress has been like nothing short of miraculous. So I don't know, maybe it's working. I don't know.
I think that the question is like, well, on that I'll ask, like kind of, I agree that the progress is phenomenal. But number one, we have to ask ourselves, like, how much of the progress is due to the publication system, or is the publication system like, an artifact, or at best of this progress, right? And again, in addition, like, it is like, what is it that we want to, the question again, like kind of comes back to like, what is it that we're trying to optimize, right? With the system, are we trying to optimize the progress for the AI industry? Or are we trying to, kind of like, or are we trying to optimize for, intellectual rigor? Who knows, right?
Do you think there is a point of trying to keep track of sort of the most recent, the best and newest stuff? Or is it maybe not worth it? Or if it's worth it, then any sort of ideas, given the volume, how to?
I think it's again, like, I think that it is some, I think that it's tough. Like what I see is that somehow, right, the good ideas surface in this world, like and I don't know that it's necessarily surfaced through the fact that they're accepted to like kind of one publication, like kind of one conference or another. Publishing your idea right now is essentially free. Anybody can like put it on the archive. So I think that it's just like there's implicitly there's some sort of like kind of you know, the there is some kind of you know, kind of like, you know, experts process, right, that's happening, where somehow, like, kind of the I feel like kind of the breakthrough ideas, or the kind of like the good ideas, kind of they surface. What I do find is that, like, is that I guess, you know, students and also kind of like, you know, now kind of like employees need to be like a little bit educated about, you know, the you know, about the now kind of like maybe the value of papers, or so I think kind of one thing that you find is that, you know, as an academics, you know, you kind of know that there are, you know that there are people that have that are very, you know, have like kind of strong reputation, and you sort of like, you know, you follow their work, or, you know, they're like kind of where, you know, you kind of like have a sense of like when things are going to be reproducible, when things are not going to be reproducible. You develop some intuition on kind of like what sort of work one can trust. What you find is that, like, you know, that's a skill that, you know, that you've kind of trained internally, like, for, you know, for a good number of years, but you know, now kind of like you know, folks in a research lab that don't have kind of like that academic training, or you know, or students, you know, to them, like, any paper in the archives looks like a serious paper, and that's kind of when when you have to guide them a little bit on, you know, on knowing that, you know, not to be surprised that maybe some things are not exactly reproducible, knowing that sometimes, like, you know, there are kind of like claims that are not really valid, or and, you know, and that's important, because, like, people, you know, you don't want people kind of like going on, like, in kind of like you know, in directions that you don't think will bear fruit.
So you maybe develop some sort of sense of what's important and what's, or at least what's what can be trusted.
I think so. I think that any good academic should have a sense of like what is important, what will be important. In addition to that, I think you also need to have like that skill of like you should have intuition about. You know, what is you know, kind of like about what is quality work and what isn't, you know. Otherwise, you know, we probably wouldn't have been here. Right? We would have spent all our time like trying to read 10,000 like NERP submissions, right? So
that's a problem.
Yeah.
So maybe. A sort of different question, like, now, so you were in academia for quite some time, and recently you went full time to industry. Do you see yourself going back to academia, or you think you'll sort of for the foreseeable future you will stay?
You know, one never knows, right? So, like, my dad is 82, and he just, you know, kind of finished writing a new paper about something, you know, completely new. Which is, you know, very interesting, and then he's now kind of writing the follow-up papers. So I definitely see that as, you know, like as a role model. So I can definitely see myself also, you know, going back to academia, you know, and in general, just sort of like, you know, working on research and doing that. So you know, I've been a little bit more, you know, kind of like in the running a company in the past few years, which kind of like, you know, that requires like a, you know, kind of flexing different muscles. But like, I hope that my research skills are, you know, still intact, and that I can and exercise them more, you know, in the coming years. So
now I have to ask you, you know, like. About AI, how can we avoid talking about that, right? So as AI becomes increasingly integrated in the economy, what do you think are the tasks and skills which are sort of next in line for automation, or the opposite? Is it like what should we tell our students? You know, they should learn to stay relevant.
Okay, so those are two interesting questions. I think that candidly, maybe this is a bad answer, but I think that the answer is like AI. I feel like AI is going to be integrated everywhere. I do feel like right now we have generally, I'm for anybody who knows me from either as an academic or as a CEO or as an executive, knows that I'm typically like skeptical, sometimes cynical. But I do have to say that in this case, I genuinely believe that the technology that we have today, right now, the capabilities are transformative, and they will transform like every aspect of our lives. So when I think about where AI is going to be integrated in business, I cannot think of a single vertical of business where AI is not going to have, basically disrupt like an entire industry, because I do believe that we've reached that level of automation where every vertical can, just can make phenomenal progress. I look at the space that that I find myself in, which is obviously AI, but then also cybersecurity. I feel like there is just like massive disruption there. But I know of other fields that I've touched and I'm aware of, like every other aspect, can be and will be disrupted fundamentally. So when it comes to what people should study.
Anything left for us?
Anything left for us? I think everything is left for us. I think it's, for computer scientists, I think this is a lot of it is there's a lot of automation, but there's also a great demand for for great ideas and ingenuity, and also a need to understand a need for understanding the fundamentals and rigorous thinking. My recommendation just for students, I think as it always has been, it's emphasis on the fundamentals and the foundations, because especially when you see the rate of change moving so quickly, right? Learning how to be an AI engineer today is very different from what it's going to be 3 months from now, 6 months from now, and a year from now. So but I kind of I give my dad as an example earlier. My dad is, my dad had a 60-something year career, and everything that he learned back in undergrad, he's still using that. He's still, and obviously, technology evolved dramatically, and the world has gone through a lot. But those fundamentals, those strong foundations, allow him to keep on learning and keep on evolving, developing, doing new things. So that's the best advice that I could give to people. Learn the fundamentals, learn the foundations, especially in undergrad, because I feel like that's the, it's not the only chance you'll get, but it's definitely the best one. So
it's a great role model, your dad. It's really impressive.
I
kind of think that in a sense chasing the latest technology is kind of a never-ending thing, right? It's like I agree with you, you have to have some sort of basis for thinking about things, otherwise it's changing every month now.
I have to say that I see that in industry you see that a lot, and this is something that we try to instill in everybody who's been working at at our company at Robust Intelligence, but then now kind of like also like our team, like you know, our team at you know, at Cisco. There's something about you know, you're not going to teach them, or I'm not going to teach them, you know, analysis or calculus or you know or whatever. But there is something about thinking like kind of basically thinking in frameworks and kind of like and having that kind of you know, and kind of thinking like a little bit more rigorously about something, right? So rather than just sort of like thinking that, you know, of pouring out code on something, you really want to like people to sort of understand that, okay, there's a, you know, there's a model here, there's a framework, and we're going to treat, you know, this as, you know, as this building block, and then we're going to apply kind of like an algorithm here, and for people to kind of like understand that that framework is really, really important, and that really kind of allows them to make a lot of progress. So the more that we instill that kind of, you know, disciplinary thinking in, you know, in education, you know, before undergrad, during undergrad, I think that people will benefit, you know, tremendously from that, you know, as they go into industry.
Do you think anything can slow down the AI process's development? Maybe, I don't know, it could be regulatory, it could be social, any bottleneck that you can or it's just like
I think that they're like, well, like, you know, my opinion here is as good as anyone's, but like I think that there are like obviously like kind of geopolitical tensions that, right, that can arise, that can like kind of, you know, we can expect like maybe a slowdown, and you know, and maybe it could be like chip manufacturing or what have you. Regulatory, like you know, fortunately or unfortunately, like depending on which side, you know, the fence you're on, I don't, you know, historically, like, you know, with kind of like with technology, like, you don't really see regulatory being a you know, a real showstopper. So I don't see that.
Nuclear is a counterexample.
Nuclear, well, you know, the other powers at play there, but I think that you know, the things that could happen, like you know, we could see kind of like kind of like change in the economic conditions, right? All of a sudden, you know, there's DeepSeek too that's going to come out, and NVIDIA is going to lose like you know, I don't know, like more trillions, or you know, the whole stock market is going to lose more trillions, and investors could be less bullish about AI, and now we're going to like be a little bit in a, there's going to be a little bit of a cool down. So all those things I can, you know, it's, you know, the geopolitical tensions, the kind of like economic downturns for various reasons, like all those I can, you know, those feel very real, and I can very see them happening somewhere along the way. But generally speaking, I think that directionally, you know, so directionally, like I just think that we're going to continue on, you know, just making this like, you know, unbelievable, you know, just incredible progress. So there could be like, you know, somewhere in the future, there could be like 6 months or a year or maybe a couple of years, a few years of like maybe some sort of slowdowns. But directionally, I just sort of like, you know, if you look at like, you know, where are we going to be 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 40 years from now, we'll just continue on seeing like a very strong trajectory of progress.
So more just keep pushing forward.
I think so. By the way, like if we sort of look at this, like, you know, like let's, if we kind of like open the kind of like the window on this, like, you know, thinking about this from a long, you know, longer time horizon perspective, we can start thinking about the development of AI, you know, all the way back, you know, to Turing, right? And kind of, cause you know, like, that has been like kind of very much the driver, you know, of computer science, kind of like, you know, it's not only building kind of computerized systems, but actually building intelligent systems. So, you know, looking at this of like kind of how much, you know, you know, the, you know, I think we started making like this sort of like the serious investment and quest into like building intelligent systems starting from the 50s, right? Turing, von Neumann. Then it's like when you look at it from that perspective, you know, over the past now, what is it, 75 years. It's just, tremendous progress, and then just going to continue.
Actually, Turing, interestingly enough, predicted that we will have systems which can pass the Turing test by year 2000. Not a bad prediction, a little bit off, but not that much.
And I have to say that, one of the things that, for me personally, has been astonishing is that if you'd asked me 5 years ago whether we'll pass the Turing test in our lifetime, my answer would have been no. To me, it just seemed like something that was just insurmountable. 5 years ago, I think that was still after BERT, right? And I still didn't see it. So I think it's amazing.
Yeah, I have to say I haven't seen the writing on the wall either until basically ChatGPT came out. That was kind of maybe I'll ask you another question about the startup Robust Intelligent that you co-founded. What sort of induced you to start a startup, and how did you think about it? And did you think, did you plan it to be a kind of a big thing, or you thought it was a small side venture and which kind of grew? What was your trajectory in this?
Yeah, let's see. So I think that I was very much interested in and understanding the vulnerabilities, right, of AI, the vulnerability of AI, the sensitivity of it, what have you, and understanding how to overcome it. During my time in academia, I wrote some papers on it, and then we also we initiated a large grant with a project with a few universities. So it was very interesting to me, and I very much wanted this. I was very interested in this and this is a project, and I actually wanted to really. I wanted to really do this. I wanted to do to build something and see that see that something get adopted in the real world, and I think that it felt to me that probably the only way to do it is actually to start a company, you're sort of once you want to have something that is adopted, a framework that is actually adopted in, in the real world, then I feel like that's when you sort of you need to cross over from academia, whereas the major effort is the intellectualizing about it, and then I feel like the implementation aspect or the adoption aspect probably is best, the industry is just most suitable. So that's what led us, I think, to venture off into doing a company. I think it's been an interesting ride. Yeah.
So let me maybe ask you now, what sort of books, podcasts, or anything interesting outside of your direct area, outside of maybe directly computer science, that sort of have captured your interest or imagination recently? Anything you would recommend?
I'm very interested in just what's going on in in the world in general. So I'm an avid reader of The Economist. For years it's only when I'm on vacation I can actually read it cover to cover. So, but I always want to. But I, I do read The Economist on a regular basis. Some business publications as well. And then, I obviously just keep up with. With everything that's happening in the AI world, And every so, you know, not as often as I used to, but like I kind of, you know, now kind of like when there is like kind of a paper or something like that is, or like a lecture about like, you know, some technology that I think is like is actually very interesting. So I kind of like, I do get into that, you know, deeply. And then, you know, otherwise, you know, I'm interested a lot in, you know, kind of a history and kind of politics. So I'm originally from Israel. So I'm interested in kind of like, you know, kind of everything kind of that's going on in, you know, in that region and you know, that relates to that. So that's kind of, those are the kinds of things I do.
Anything particularly exciting in AI area? Good or bad, you know, maybe we die or we live, I don't know.
Anything that's exciting in the AI area? Well, I mean, like, whatever I'm going to say now is probably going to become obsolete by the time that, you know, that this comes out.
That will be interesting, too.
You know, I'm interested a lot in, I'm interested, you know, like, you know, now I'm like, I'm very biased with the things that I'm interested in. I'm a little bit more interested in engineering. I'm actually very interested in, like, so Anthropic released this framework called MCP, which is basically kind of like a protocol for, it's a very useful protocol, that helps build agentic systems. And I think that's something that's like, you know, that I've been kind of like, you know, digging into. So, you know, it's more engineering than it is something that is like some sort of like masterful proof or like an amazing algorithm or like kind of a Transformers like breakthrough. But it's something that, you know, like for us is actually kind of like really, really important. So that's something that I'm actually very interested in, and basically kind of basically protocols that allow us to bring in to basically kind of like bring in data like kind of live into an agentic system. That's a capability that right now, like without a protocol like that, we don't have that. That's something I am like interested in. So that's kind of a recent thing that I've been looking into.
Maybe we can recommend to our students that they learn MCP.
Oh, please, yeah. If they, you know, and then come tell us about it, because you know, like yeah, we're very interested. So yeah.
Well, thank you for your time and insight today, Aaron. Real pleasure talking with you. And thank you for joining us on another episode of Science Like Me Plus.